from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis returns from World Youth Day in Panama with a long list of tasks before him. The sex abuse meeting in February, finishing the reform of the Roman Curia, and heading out again into the Islamic world. This week on Register Radio, we talk to Vatican correspondent Edward Penton. Plus, abortion laws across the country are becoming more radical. What's happening, and how is a pro-life movement responding? We're joined by Christine Russell of the Catholic News Agency. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register Senior Editor and co-host for Register Radio. My co-host, Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, is away on maternity leave. Well, Pope Francis celebrated Mass for some 700,000 young people in Panama this last week as part of World Youth Day. It was a remarkable moment, but much of the media's attention is focused not on that, but on the in-flight press conference where he addressed the sex abuse crisis and the Church's discipline on celibacy. It was one of those remarkable episodes that raised as many questions as it provided answers. To help answer some of those questions, I have the delight of being rejoined by Edward Penton, the National Catholic Register's Rome correspondent. Edward, welcome back.
Hi, good to be with you again, Matthew.
So Pope Francis, on his return to Rome from World Youth Day, held one of those press conferences that I imagine for everyone in media and even outside of media, we tend to circle those whenever the Pope is on a trip because we just know that something interesting is going to happen. And sure enough, I think the Pope did not disappoint, did he?
No, he didn't. He spoke about a wide range of subjects, he does, and a few obviously caused drew quite a bit of attention. And I focused on one particular aspect of what he said regarding what he spoke about married priests and the possibility of ordaining married priests.
Well, you had a post with the National Catholic Register that it caught my eye the minute you actually had it up, because it talks about that the Holy Father is sort of reiterating his commitment to celibacy, but then maybe not. Or the exact way you put it is Pope Francis says no, then maybe to married priests. What exactly happened here?
Yes, well, he made a point of saying that he could never never favor or support the idea of ordaining married men into the priesthood in the Latin Rite. Of course, there are some exceptions, notably the Anglicans who come over to Rome, who have been married, can also be ordained. But apart from that, there are no other cases in the Latin Rite. And he said that he wouldn't want to do that. It's not a decision he'd ever want to make. He also quoted St. Paul the VI about this, and Paul the VI saying quite firmly that that the celibacy rule shouldn't be changed. But on the other hand, he then spoke about the need for exceptions in order to fill a gap of priest shortages around the world, in particular in remote parts of the world. And he kind of, although he didn't fully support them, he did at least entertain the idea of that. And this is quite significant because it's a talked about subject ahead of the upcoming synod on the Amazon in October, when many people think that this issue is going to be brought to the fore and perhaps smuggled in the back door, some people think, but others who support it think it's the rightful that this issue is discussed, and that this problem of reaching those who don't have priests, who have suffer from a shortage of priests, that this could be a way to do it. So that's why he brought it up.
Yeah, now, one of the concerns that was immediately raised, as you note, is that what would stop, say, hypothetically, the German bishops from saying, well, we have a similar pastoral crisis here, so full speed ahead on ordaining the so-called viri probati, which is a term that's used for seasoned men who are presumably married, who then would function as priests. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think that's exactly right, Matthew. This is the concern that, although it will be allowed for the Amazon, for example, where there is a shortage of priests in the Amazon there, lots of people who go without sacraments because of a shortage of priests, people feel that will be universally applied where there is any shortage of priests, as in fact there are in many parts of the Western world. And so it'll spread there. So many people think, as I said earlier, that they think this is a sort of backdoor approach to allowing married priests into the Latin Rite. And And the interesting thing is the person he quoted about this, Bishop Fritz Lobinger, who's a 90-year-old German bishop, who's long advocated this virum probatae. He's in fact pioneered it, whereby a community of elders, a team of elders, would be ordained without even going to seminary to carry out the sacramental aspects of the priesthood, not the governing or the teaching, but the sacramental aspects. He spoke quite at length about this theory, which apparently was recommended to him by Cardinal Reinhard Marx back in 2015. So he's clearly wants to entertain this idea and have it considered, even if he may not agree with it himself.
Right. And in fairness to Pope Francis, he was, I thought, pretty strong in his endorsement of celibacy. That the quote from Pope St. Paul VI, essentially saying, I would rather die than to have this change. And yet he seemed remarkably conversant with Bishop Lobinger's book, noting all of the details that you just did.
Exactly, yes. And he knew it very well and sort of give mixed signals, because he did say that this is something that needs to be prayed about, rethought about. And so clearly he wants this idea discussed and quite strongly considered, probably at the upcoming synod at the Amazon, also because he's appointed various people to prepare that conference, that synod, and at least a few of them are openly in favor of ordaining married men, and in some cases ordaining women as priests.
And, of course, something tells me that in the coming months, you and I will be having more conversations about the looming question of deaconesses, but that's probably for another day, isn't it?
Yes, that's another possibility of trying to have the issue of women priests discussed again, even though it's been strongly ruled out by John Paul II.
So Pope Francis arrived back in Rome and has to begin work immediately to prepare for another upcoming trip. He's heading to the United Arab Emirates, which will bring him realistically into the very heart of the Muslim world. What's at work here?
Yes, well, this is a very significant trip for the Holy Father, for any pope, because this is the first time a pope will have traveled to the Arab Peninsula. It's also a very interesting part of the Arab Peninsula. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, is very much a growing part of that region. It's becoming ever more influential. And it's also, of course, borders Saudi Arabia. And there's hope that perhaps it'll spark greater religious freedom, not only in the UAE and the Gulf states, but also in neighboring Saudi Arabia. So it's a potentially very significant event, a very significant trip, even though it's only 3 days.
Yeah, and my understanding is that you'll be taking part in that papal visit. Is that right?
Yes, I'll be on the plane with the Pope, so I'll be hopefully reporting back regularly as much as I can on that trip for EWTN and the Register.
So he's there from February 3rd to the 5th. He's going to be greeted by the Crown Prince of the country, as well as a visit to the Grand Mosque. So it does strike me that these types of meetings, including the one with the Muslim Council of Elders, they have great symbolic value, but also potential for the advancement of interreligious dialogue, which I know was a significant project of the late Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine, who is in charge of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue.
Yes. In fact, he was only last year, about a few months before he died, he went to the region and, in fact, traveled to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia for a historic meeting with King Al Saud. And that was a very significant breakthrough there, and it shows, I think, the advances that they're trying to make in that region towards religious freedom. There's a long way to go, of course, in Saudi Arabia. You still can't build churches there, and even in the Gulf states, it's not allowed to express or worship openly. It has to be within a church. And so the open-air mass that the Pope is going to celebrate in Abu Dhabi is going to be also very historic and significant, because that has never been done before. And so there's going to be quite a few milestones in this trip.
Well, exactly. I was just about to ask you about the significance of having a holy mass at, I think it's a Zayed Sports City Stadium, instead of in the cathedral in Abu Dhabi. But what is so striking about that is, first, as you note, this open-air mass, which is almost unheard of, I should think, but also the presence of a cathedral in Abu Dhabi, a recognition of the number of Catholics from around the world who are actually living there.
That's right, yes. There's a huge number of Catholics there. And in fact, the 135,000 are expected at the mass from what is, you know, a very much a Muslim-majority country. But there are 10%, I think, of the population of UAE is made up of Christians. And so a lot of them work as migrants, laborers. They come from places like Kerala in India and Southeast Asia. And so there are many there, and they need a lot of pastoral help. There's a lot of challenges there for them. I was there just over 10 years ago, and I did several reports for the Register there. And it's extremely hard for a lot of them. They live in poor conditions in a very rich state, and they also have quite a lot of hard work, particularly regarding domestic labor and construction, and they're not often the working conditions are very poor. So there's a lot of pastoral needs there, and I think that's also a main reason why the Pope is going to the region.
And very briefly, in the time that we have left, is there an expectation on the part of journalists that the Holy Father will make an appeal for the religious freedom for Christians across the whole of the Muslim world?
There is expectation of that. I'll have an interview up later this week about from a Jesuit priest, an expert on Islam, who says that the Pope needs to become more clearer and stronger about Islam and how that there is a need for a more sort of realistic interpretation of Islam rather than what he called a naive one. And I think there is that need, and whether the Pope actually really embraces that and actually says the need for freedom of full freedom of religion, we'll have to wait and see. But I think he'll probably try, and I think in a diplomatic way, I think he'll try to make that point and put that point across.
Well, very good. Well, Edward, be safe, and I look forward to reading your reports and talking to you more about this when you return. Let's remind everyone that they can find your work at ncregister.com. It's well worth your time. Thanks again, Edward.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Matthew.
Well, when we come back, I talk to CNA's Catholic News Agency's Christine Russell on abortion in America. This is Register Radio.
Don't miss a moment of 2019. Try 6 issues of EWTN's National Catholic Register today for free. Award-winning journalism that goes beyond what you'll find from any secular news service. With the Register, you'll get the real story behind the events that unfold over the course of the year. Try the Register for free today and get it delivered to your home, office, or parish. Want to continue your subscription after your free trial? Just pay $49.95 and you'll get a total of 26 issues filled with spiritual insights on world events, along with compelling Catholic news and information. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/NYR or call 800-421-3230 and mention code 919-NYRA. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register Senior Editor and co-host for Register Radio. My co-host, Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, is away on maternity leave. Well, as everyone in the country is now rather profoundly aware, the state of New York passed what I think can be described as the most expansive abortion law in the country, the Reproductive Health Act. This is a law that actually allows abortion for essentially any reason through the first 24 weeks of pregnancy and afterwards if a medical professional deems it necessary to protect the health of the mother. This is pretty strong, pretty radical. To talk more about this, I'm joined by Christine Russell of the Catholic News Agency, who's been covering this story very closely. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is probably not the most fun story to try to cover, but I have the impression that this is one of the most important that we have in culture today.
Yeah, it's definitely not a great story to write about in terms of things that are fun to write about, but it's super important because it's a lot of misconceptions are being brought to light, and it's really eye-opening for a lot of people, even people who call themselves pro-choice or pro-abortion, to see what the reality of this law actually is and what was actually just signed into law in New York State and what is being considered by several other states.
So what exactly does this law allow, and are there any limitations on abortion?
So this law, the Reproductive Health Act, allows for abortion for any reason at all, not even essentially any reason, just literally any reason at all, through the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. And we know that babies who have been born at around 22 or 23 weeks have survived. It also allows abortion after the 24th week of pregnancy for reasons that to protect the health or well-being of the mother, which is a very, very vague medical term that doesn't actually have any sort of judicial meaning. And it basically just means if a doctor or medical professional signs off on the abortion can happen. And it doesn't require a doctor to consider any other reason to help solve the medical crisis. It just allows the doctor to say that abortion is necessary.
And in terms of just basic law, how dangerous is it now to be an unborn child in New York?
I'd say it's probably significantly more dangerous than it was a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of legal challenges are we expecting?
Right now, I'm not entirely sure if anyone's filed suit against the law. I know that there was a 12-year legislative battle to even get the law passed. It was originally proposed in 2007. And after the past election, which saw Democratic control of both houses of New York's legislature for the first time in a pretty long time, the bill was basically like railroaded through and there was no chance of stopping it.
Okay. So New York, I want to come back to New York in mm-hmm. a minute, but this is just one of several states that are looking at or have already passed similar laws. Is that right?
Yeah. New Mexico is considering something similar along with Rhode Island. And a bill in Virginia to legalize abortion through the third trimester was defeated Tuesday.
Right. So here we are going back to New York on this. What is the rationale for imposing this kind of a law on a state that also has, and we'll talk more about that in a second, such a sizable Catholic population?
Well, there's an effort to codify basically parts of Roe v. Wade into law in case that the decision is found to be overturned by the Supreme Court in the future. So they're basically trying to – or states are trying to get a right to abortion, a right, quote, quote, to abortion in their state constitutions or in some form of law in case Roe were to be overturned. Last year, Massachusetts passed what they called the Nasty Woman Act. So it was something like negating archaic statutes, something – I can't remember the whole acronym.
Right.
But prior to this law, if Roe were to be overturned, a trigger law in Massachusetts would make abortion illegal. And New York's Reproductive Health Act also removed abortion from the criminal code and put it in the health code. So as some people pointed out, if a man throws his wife or girlfriend down the stairs and she loses the baby, he wouldn't be charged with fetal homicide anymore because that would not be considered a person until the baby is born.
Right. And are we not to get into too many of the gruesome, horrifying details, but if a person, a woman decides to have an abortion, as you know, right up almost to birth, what exactly does that entail? I'm hearing things like lethal injection.
Yeah, there's. It's not as commonly used anymore, but there was the saline abortion, which abortion survivor Gianna Jessen survived when she was, I think, like 25 weeks gestation. And so that would be an injection of saline that basically kills the baby as they swallow saline. There's also an injection to the baby's to the unborn baby's heart that basically kills the fetus, and then a delivery is done. Or there's it's some states have banned this procedure, but it basically, like, they call it a dismemberment abortion, is that's what pro-lifers refer to the act
right.
as, and it's there's really no nice way to put it,
right,
but
exactly.
It requires the removal of the unborn baby with forceps.
Yes, the title itself tells you something about dismemberment.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have the state legislature approving this type of a bill.
Mm-hmm.
We have Governor Cuomo seemingly to have staked not just his reputation, such as it is, but also all of his political weight behind this. Why?
Cuomo is unlike his father, who claimed to at least be personally opposed to abortion, but as a member of the Democratic Party, he's basically obligated to promote it, as we saw last year with Representative Dan Lipinski barely got the support of the DCCC because he's the one of a handful of remaining pro-life Democrats, and he was challenged in one of the most expensive primary races ever by somebody who is a pro-choice Democrat. So the Democrats have access to abortion funded by the taxpayers as a plank in their party platform. So Cuomo has just really embraced this aspect of the party platform and almost shamelessly ordered various monuments throughout the state of New York to be lit up in bright pink to celebrate, again, quote, quote, celebrate the passage of the Reproductive Health Act, which has drawn the ire of some of the bishops in the state.
Yeah. And the response of the bishops itself has been somewhat controversial. I know your colleague Ed Condon has written extensively, and I think J.D. Flynn has too, right, mm-hmm. about what are the prospects for excommunication.
I'm going to leave that one to the canon lawyers. they have degrees, and I don't. So
exactly.
I will leave that to them.
But in terms of the response of the church and the pro-life movement, what has been that response?
In New York, at least, I saw kind of a sense of defeat of – I mean, I don't want to, like, hold this against them because, like, the church in New York stalled this law for 12 years, which is, like, really saying something. And the pro-life movement in New York remains strong, and the Sisters of Life are based in the Bronx. But at this point, I think they kind of just shrugged and were like, well, like, we tried, which is a horrible kind of feeling. But at the end of the day, elections have consequences, and this is a consequence of the last election.
Well, your piece on this, new state-level laws show time is running out for Roe, pro-lifers say. Is it safe to say that these new laws are a kind of reaction to the progress of the pro-life movement?
Yeah, definitely. As I quoted somebody in that piece from a pro-life organization, the state level is really where abortion should be hashed out, not on the federal level. And the argument presented in the Roe decision is a pretty weak one, legally speaking. And I don't think it's even beyond the realm of possibility that it gets overturned at some point in the future, which would then send the issue back to the states to decide. So states like Mississippi and Louisiana would probably immediately outlaw it outright. But as a state like New York, which legalized abortion prior to the Roe decision, would obviously the laws are on the books to keep it legal throughout the second the baby's born.
Yeah. And is there an effort, do you think, to try to define personhood legally, not just in individual states, but on the federal level? And is that potentially an avenue for looking at abortion?
I think it's potentially an avenue, but it's also going to be a very sticky one to decide because, I mean, they were getting into like pretty deep philosophical questions
yeah,
of like, what is a person? Like,
and when does
what does this
begin?
Mean? Like, I mean, as a Catholic, I believe life begins at conception, but I think personhood is a, you know, it's a weird not a weird concept, but it's like a very – it's a tough to define legal concept that – I mean, I do think that these laws though and the stories that are coming out of it where people are kind of waking up and saying, hold on, like I'm pro-choice, but if you're 7 months pregnant, like that's clearly a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that laws like this are at least sparking a conversation amongst people who thought they had a set position on abortion that are trying to like rethink these things.
Yeah, and I know you've been tracking the whole life movement, especially in New York these past weeks. What else are we seeing that could be a threat to the culture of life? Because I understand that euthanasia might be
mm-hmm.
opened up now.
Yeah, euthanasia is being debated in a few states, but that one's a tougher sell than abortion because, I mean, like even in Massachusetts, they voted it down, and Massachusetts is a pretty blue state. But I think that once people learn more about euthanasia, they start to be like a little more iffy on the issue. Even like with movies like Me Before You, we saw the reaction to that amongst various groups, including like disability advocates who are like, hold on, like,
right.
We're not dead. Like there's literally a group called Not Dead Yet. And they're like, our lives are worth living. And it's not right for people to be basically like written off and just told to go to a clinic in Switzerland and kill themselves. And there's stories, too, out of like the Netherlands where children are being euthanized and people with mental illnesses that are treatable, like anorexia, are being euthanized, basically.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a movement to bring that to the United States, but I think it's going to be a lot harder sell than abortion was.
Well, you've been at this now for about a year with the Catholic News Agency, is that right?
Yes.
How's it been?
It's been a very interesting year. A lot of very interesting and unexpected news stories have broken since my time here at CNA, but it's been honestly a pleasure to cover it since I like to tell the truth to people and I like to bring that truth to the world.
And D.C.'s kind of a tough beat, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely a tough beat. And I've learned a lot about former bishops here in the last year that I did not think I'd really be learning about. But I mean, it's been kind of, pardon the pun, a baptism by fire, but it's been an absolutely incredible experience.
And you also recently took part in a panel. I'd love to hear more about that.
Oh, yes. I was a panelist at the Red Maryland Leadership Conference where we discussed building a culture of life in a blue state like Maryland, and or basically how to protect life in a blue state where nothing in Maryland is going to get passed on a legislative level on terms of abortion law that will help the pro-life side. Like, that's just simply not going to happen. Their governor, who is a Republican, is a pro-abortion Republican who just – I mean, he just isn't – like, he's a very moderate Republican. Popular, but moderate Republican. And so I talked about how it's important for people on a very, very local level, because all politics is local, to, you know, ensure that, like, their public schools have policies to, like, assist pregnant students so they don't feel like they have to, like, have an abortion to stay in school. Or how, like, to work with church groups to provide for moms in crisis pregnancies to help them, like, carry their kid to term and to, you know, provide baby clothes. Because not the government shouldn't be responsible for everything if it doesn't have to be. And I think that there's nothing really stopping the local population from, like, really taking care of each other.
Yeah. Well, what are you working on now?
Right now I'm actually doing more about the proposed Virginia law that is not happening and an upcoming Supreme Court case.
Can we assume that that law will be identical if along the lines of New York?
Oh, well, that law was pretty similar. I don't know all of the, like, nitty-gritty aspects of it, but its sponsor in a now-viral video admitted yesterday that her bill would allow for the abortion of an unborn baby literally while the mother was in active labor, which, again, caused a lot of, like, interesting reactions from people on both sides of the aisle.
Understood. Well, I look forward to reading it and to following your work, and also to having you back on Register Radio. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's it for Register Radio this week. My renewed thanks to Edward Penton and Christine Russell. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. And remember to listen to our podcasts. Thanks so much for joining me here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week. God bless.